It is Columbia Morning on News Talk 1400 KFRU. I have the Chief of Staff of the Truman Memorial Veterans Hospital with me. She was here several months ago. Dr. Lana Zaire is here. It's good to see you again. How are you?
Hi, David. Thank you.
So I'm just going to, for the fun of it, let me go back to what I was talking to Tori about a while ago. Do you have the summer job or memories?
I do. I was a lifeguard for a couple of summers, and that was fun. But that taught me that I need to wear sunscreen every day because I did get some bad burns. And then I did my dermatology rotation in medical school and realized that I was going to be really wrinkled when I got older. And one summer, the pool was closed down, and I worked at a deli making sandwiches.
Oh, neat. Where was this?
That was in Park Hills, Missouri, small town south of St. Louis.
You know, you look back at those summer jobs, and again, many of us are at the age where it was just expected.
Right.
But I don't know. I mean, you have a daughter my daughter's age, and we both have daughters, and I'm not sure at what point. I jokingly said to her the other day, I said, you know, maybe if you're bored and sleeping till 10 or 11, you need a job.
Exactly. I agree.
But I think in a couple of years, I mean, they're 14 now. In a couple of years, that will make more sense than it is now.
Right.
But I know some kids that are 15, 16 years old that are having summer jobs now. And I don't know. It's just kind of part of it. But other activities. I mean, your daughter's going to be an athlete. Others are in band and things like that. It's just other activities, I think, kind of crowd in.
They do. But I remember I needed money. And I know that my parents weren't just giving me money.
Yeah.
So if I wanted to do something, I had to go out and make some money.
Either that or learn that money isn't going to be that important and just learn to get by without it. I mean,
right.
I tapered off my wants quite a bit so that I didn't have to make as much money as probably
right.
I should have. You have a piece that you've written, and it's called Immediate Sequential Cataract Surgery, Making a Case for Integrated Care. I think for many of us who are not in the medical field, that's kind of complicated to get through. But as I understand this, what's the situation now at the VA hospital when someone wants cataract surgery?
Currently at the VA, if we send our patients a lot of times to the optometrist for a routine eye exam, and that's to get a glasses prescription, check for glaucoma, check for any eye diseases. It's a screening. At that exam, if the optometrist finds significant cataracts, then they will take measurements that day for surgery, and then they will see an ophthalmologist that day, and then we schedule them for surgery. That's the scheme currently at the VA. Now, it's taken a while to get to that point because we had to build up the program. You know, previously, you'd have to come in for multiple visits, but now it's a one visit, one-stop shop. You get scheduled for cataract surgery.
Would you have surgery on both eyes in the same time?
Well, that's a good question, because in most places in the United States, you don't have surgery on both eyes. And a lot of people who've had cataract surgery, I hear this all the time, they'll have surgery on one eye and then a few weeks later go back and have surgery on the second eye. It never had occurred to me. I haven't needed cataract surgery yet. So when my chief of ophthalmology approached me and said, we should start doing, and he called it bilateral cataract surgery, I thought, why not? Why shouldn't we do this? This makes a lot of sense. Because currently, patients have to come in twice to get measurements and to have post-operative visits. So it's two exact episodes of care, and it's taking up space in our clinics. It's taking up space in our ORs. So we looked into it to get it started.
And how has it worked?
It's working great.
It would also save money. I mean, a lot of medical care is about money. So basically, you're going to under anesthesia if you needed that, or the preparation for whatever the surgery is like for cataract surgery, and also less exams, less of this kind of thing. So you're saving money also.
We are saving a lot of money. And in the VA, our budget is based on how many patients we take care of per year. We get a big bulk of money, and then they say, go out and take care of these patients. And it's really based on who we've taken care of in the past few years. So if we do more procedures on one patient, we're kind of losing money. So we make more money, in a sense, for keeping patients well and doing less procedures, in a way.
I read this and I hear what you're saying, and I think there are two points. One is, do you feel threatened by those who would change the VA way of doing something?
Absolutely.
So what is the threat?
I think the threat, in regards to what I wrote about bilateral cataract surgery, is privatization. Our secretary has spoken a couple of times about what should the VA be doing and what kind of care should the VA be providing. And one of the examples he mentioned was lens crafters. He said, if you can get a pair of eyeglasses on any corner or at any mall in the country, it's a very simple thing, he said. then why should the VA provide that? But my argument is that seeing an eye doctor for an eye screening for eye disease and having comprehensive and integrated eye care is something that the VA can offer, but lens crafters cannot offer. We're losing that continuity of care. We're losing that integration if we send veterans out for these piecemeal episodes of care.
So in other words, some would be saying that there are certain things that you provide that you don't need to provide any longer because they're at other places.
Correct.
Easily to get at other places.
Easy
and I would be one of those. But the lens crafter's not doing cataract surgery.
They're not doing cataract surgery. They're not measuring people for cataract surgery. They don't have eye surgeons in their clinic, and they're not providing that follow-up care. They might say to the patient, you have a big cataract. You need to go see an eye doctor, an eye surgeon for this. But they're not doing anything to move that forward.
Are there other parts of the VA services now that are in that same category that somebody would say, well, you know, why don't we stop doing this and let somebody else do this?
There are always conversations about that. So the other thing that the secretary has mentioned is maybe podiatry. Hmm. And when I see new veterans, I think they all have two eyes and two feet, and they're going to see optometry and they're going to see podiatry. We have a big need for podiatry services, and it's a very busy clinic. So he talks maybe the feet are, you know, separated from the body. Maybe we could have someone else take care of the feet. But our podiatry services are completely integrated with our general surgeons and our orthopedic surgeons. They do surgery in our OR. They give out medications through our pharmacy. And they work very closely with our primary care providers. It's all integrated in our system. We share the same record. We share the same support services. And we can all see what has happened to that veteran.
I would say that for veterans, I think sometimes complicating matters would decrease what they would get a service, because I think when you get into a certain situation, and we hear this about veterans, that they might benefit so much by having it in one area that simplifies, and they're less likely to skip out if they have a foot problem or an eye problem or something like that. And I would say that many people who are not veterans could benefit by kind of an integrated service that way.
Absolutely. And the way that I see it is that when I see my patient in primary care clinic, we do a screening for foot disease, especially in my diabetics mm-hmm. and my patients with vascular disease. So we check their feet on a yearly basis for sensation and blood flow. And if they have any risk that their feet are going to be compromised, we send them to the podiatrist and we make sure that they go to that appointment.
The Dr. Lana Zera is our guest. She's the chief of staff at the Veterans Hospital here in Columbia. I guess the reason that somebody, and you're talking, when you talk about the secretary, you're talking about David Shulkin, right?
Correct.
I guess it's looking at a way of saving money then, huh? It gets back to money, saying if we privatize these things, we won't be paying as much because we won't have to have certain people on staff at the VA centers across the country.
I don't know. I don't know what the intent is of that, because in my opinion, you know, from what I've seen from sending care out to the community, it's less expensive to the taxpayer to keep it within the VA. I see what the bills are coming in from the private sector. I see how many times in certain specialties they want to do extra things. They want to see people more frequently. I see that it's more expensive in the private sector.
Because the private sector, and I did an interview a little with the author of a book called An American Sickness, which I find to be a terrific book. I mean, I think she goes through the history, and she's a doctor, and then she was a reporter for the New York Times and other sources. Kaiser, not Kaiser Insurance Company, but the Kaiser Medical Insurance or Health News, which is different than Kaiser Permanente or whatever else that somebody. I think she does a good job of laying out how the medical concerns, even in a non-for-profit hospital, oftentimes started by church groups, has now taken on a money-making role.
Right.
They're making a whole lot of money. Whereas Veterans Administration is run by the government, and so one of the things that they want to make sure is that they run this as inexpensively as possible.
Correct.
But you do some good things then, and so why to destroy that is beyond me.
It's beyond me as well. Our goal really is preventative care. I want to keep all of our veterans healthy. Mm-hmm. That's our goal. We don't get paid the way that private sector health companies get paid, which is for sickness, basically. You get paid for procedures and for illness visits. We want to keep our veterans as healthy as possible. I've read part of her book. I think it's fantastic. She talks a lot about the health industrial complex. I agree with her on all those aspects. Our current medical system pays for illness. It doesn't pay for health.
And indeed, and I should, at the end of the interview, I told her that we ran out of time, and I said I should tell my listeners about the economic rules of the dysfunctional medical market, and I might run those by you in just a moment, and you can kind of comment on those. I said there were two things that struck me. One is that the VA, as you describe it, is feeling threatened by those who would like to privatize certain things.
Correct.
And that would not be, that would be to the detriment of the patients, it sounds to me, in some cases.
I completely feel that it would be the, to the detriment of the patient.
The other thing is that you can establish a model that why doesn't other healthcare follow?
I think there are too many forces at play in the country right now, and these are big economic forces. And she really speaks to the fact that there's so much money in American medicine, and it's increasing. And I see it on a daily basis in the VA, and it's not just the insurance companies, and it's not just the physicians, but it's the companies that make the supplies and sell the supplies to medicine. It's companies that make equipment and sell it to physicians. I see it every single day. There are certain procedures that we used to do with a scalpel and some scissors and some sutures, and now all of a sudden I need a $200,000 stapler to do the same procedure that we did, you know, maybe a year ago without that piece of equipment.
You know, you bring up staplers. This will get me more emotionally involved in this than I care to be, but my daughter had staple surgery on her back because she had scoliosis. And so they... And insurance is still not sure about whether to cover staple surgery or not. And because in their terms, it was kind of experimental, though it's been used for several years and by many doctors in treating curves of the spine. So we had the staple procedure. It did not work. And she has since had other major back surgery 2 years from this month ago. But when you look at the charge for those staples, which are small little things, and I mean they're about the size, maybe not of a normal stapler in your office, but not much bigger than that. The cost of that, of those, unbelievably expensive for maybe four, you know, I'm talking $15,000 or more for a staple.
Right.
And I mean, it is, I think, unconscionable some of the things that we get charged for when you look at your bill, if you take a time of looking at the bill. But it's like what I talked about with Elizabeth Rosenthal. You're told oftentimes, well, insurance, you got insurance, it's going to cover it.
Right. So
and
we're okay
so don't
with
worry
it.
About it.
Right, right.
But I think you have to worry about it also when you get a bill. And if you look at your bill, if you spend any time in a hospital or long or care of some sort, you might have a $70 visit from a person who walked by the room.
Correct.
And just stuck in and say, how you doing today?
Right.
And that shows up as a doctor who might be a specialist or in the case of, you know, of a hospital stay that my daughter had 2 years ago, a massage that we didn't ask for, nor do we remember it actually being done.
Right.
And you'll get charged for that.
You do. And so I compare that, you know, and I've gotten bills from private sector episodes of care, and I couldn't understand what it was. You know, you get a charge from the anesthesiologist, you get the facility fee, you get the lab fee. So when veterans come to the VA, if they do have a copay, which some veterans do, they have an outpatient procedure done, it's a $50 copay. $50. And that's everything encompassed because it's all bundled, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Help us understand what bundling means.
So bundling is a new thing that it's not exactly new, but it's increasingly commonplace in that insurance companies will pay for a bundle of procedures instead of piecemealing it. And I know a lot of people are worried about this, but the VA has been bundling things for decades, truly. Cataract surgery, getting back to that, it's kind of difficult for me to tell why we haven't progressed to the immediate sequential cataract surgery. And that's really the bilateral cataract surgery.
Which is, again,
having both cataracts done same day, mm-hmm. same place. And, you know, the argument has been that there's an increased infection risk. So anytime you do a surgery, there's a risk of infection. And theoretically, if you are infecting one eye because you've had infected medication or an infected, a contaminated piece of equipment, then you would infect both, and then you would be blind. So yes, that's a theoretical risk. So the way that we mitigate that risk is by doing one procedure on one eye, completely tearing everything down in the OR, cleaning everything, starting over on the next eye with a completely new set of instrumentation, new medications, et cetera. So everything is sterile once again. With that procedure, doing basically two procedures at one time, the risk of infection already is minuscule, but you've even decreased it further by separating the two procedures like that.
And it still saves money.
It saves time, and it's more convenient for the patient. Mm. So you wonder, why hasn't the private sector moved to this? And I don't know, because it should be cheaper for the insurance company to do this. But if you think about all of these ophthalmologists out there who own their own same-day surgery facilities, and they're charging a facility fee, maybe they have an anesthesia provider who also charges an anesthesia fee. Well, they're charging two of those for one patient if they're coming for one procedure and then the next procedure. So when we talk about profit in medicine and the business of medicine, I think a lot of times it's hard to tell where it's coming from. Is it coming from the insurance company, the doctors, or the equipment suppliers?
So she says, one of her is say, we should ask. We should ask questions and ask the questions and continue to ask the questions, even though it makes us uncomfortable and even though it may make the provider uncomfortable. Are you an advocate of that?
I am. And it makes me uncomfortable because I'm a physician, and many times I'm questioning other physicians. Why do you want to do this? Why do you want to use this stapler when last week you didn't need this stapler? Because other than providing health care for our nation's veterans, I'm also a steward of taxpayer dollars. Mm-hmm. So I really have two roles.
Yeah, and I think that's why anytime that is being challenged by privatization or saying, well, let's just not any longer provide certain things through the VA, I think we have to question that, because that role would disappear.
It disappears. I no longer have control when it goes out to the community. Have a little bit of control, but not nearly as much as I have when it's the care is within the VA.
You asked me if you'd need headphones, and you don't, except if we want to. I do have a phone line that's blinking here. So if you just hold one of them up to the ears, I hope you'll be able to hear that. College, you have a question or comment for the doctor?
Yes. Good morning, David. This is Curtis.
Yeah, Curtis.
I attended the hospital for 17 years, and I think the nurses and I think the receptions are well. But since we have a lady, I think that she needs to look into the doctors. It's a statement. For 17 years, some of the doctors there at the hospital didn't give a true statement to the veterans. That's one of the complaints that I get, not mine, but I get from veterans. I work with a veteran organization for over 20 years now. The second thing that she can help out with the help, veterans is running through a financial problem. It's taken almost a month for veterans to get their travelers paid. This has nothing to do with me because I have money. But some of the veterans come to me and say, Curtis, if you get a chance to tell whoever's in charge, tell the lady, tell the man, get the veterans paid before they leave going back home. They need their travels paid.
Hmm. Curtis, I'm almost out of time. I just want to get a comment from Dr. Zare. Does anything he say make sense in regard to what he's talking about, doctors and the pay there?
Sure. So I listen to veterans a lot. We had a town hall last night, actually, where veterans could come in and talk to us. And these are common things that I hear. Anytime I have a complaint about a physician or a provider, a nurse, clerk, anyone, we look into it. We have patient advocates who answer the phone during the day. We have secure messaging for email. We take comments in our comment boxes, and we look into those complaints. I think that we have a very good group of physicians at the VA. We have a very loyal, very patriotic, a very mission-oriented group of physicians. And we have been very fortunate at our VA that we get great applicants. We've really attracted a good set of docs. Now, that said, we are an academic medical center. We're one of two academic medical centers in mid-Missouri, along with the University of Missouri, and the university is our affiliate. So we do get a lot of trainees through our doors. So a lot of times I get complaints about residents. We're training the nation's doctors. So this is something that if I hear a complaint about a resident, I take that as a moment to teach them and make them better for the future. So I want to hear about those things. Travel pay is also a big complaint. And, you know, we used to pay, I think, 27 cents a mile. Now it's up to about 48 or 49 cents a mile for travel pay. That's a lot of money. And so the VA nationally has changed the way that we reimburse people. They've changed some of the guidelines, and that hasn't set well with a lot of veterans, and I can see why. So anytime people have a complaint about that, again, the patient advocate is the place to go and let us know where we can improve our processes.
Help me understand travel pay, meaning you pay for the travel distance from like northeast Missouri or something like that to Columbia?
We do. Or, so it depends if a veteran is eligible for travel pay or not. Not everyone is. So if a veteran, say, lives in Sedalia and they need to come to the Columbia VA to see cardiology, then we will pay them about 48 cents a mile to drive to Columbia and drive back.
I didn't know of that. And that is why?
That is something that Congress instituted a long time ago. Yeah. And it's one of those things that I think that it does help to get people to come in and see us, for sure. And a lot of times, you know, we have veterans who live out in the rural communities and of lower income. And truly, it's the only way that they can get here to see us. Yeah. So it's one of those things that has risk and reward. And in general, though, I think it's a good program.
Well, I appreciate you coming in and talking to us. It's really educational for me, and I'm sure for our listeners, and I hope we can do it again. Thank you.
I appreciate it. Thank you, David.
Dr. Lana Zare, who is the chief of staff at the VA hospital in Columbia. This is KFRU, Columbia, Missouri.